Friends, I think we'll start. Bishop George Browning is also joining us in a few minutes. He'll speak about the environmental network. But Jenny Tepa is with us. And Jenny, of course, is the principal of St. John's Seminary in Auckland, but is here in her capacity as a member of the Peace and Justice Network. And so I've asked her just to speak for a couple of minutes about that, and then we'll open it up to some questions. And as I say, by that point, I think Bishop George will be here as well. You.
Okay, thank you. Nice to see old friends and new friends again. The Peace and Justice Network, I actually did a little bit of homework on it because although some of us have been members of the network for some time, we, when pressed for the precise details, couldn't come up with the facts. So we do know that the ACC meeting in 1984 officially blessed the Peace and Justice Network into existence. So in that sense, we understand we are the oldest of the communions networks, 25 years. It began, and Naeem Atik, who's here at this meeting, was a member of the first meeting. So you can guess what the issue was. One of the pressing issues on the agenda was to do with Israel-Palestine. And interestingly, the language used in the ACC resolution for the establishment of the network was that of peacemaking. So clearly that was the concept behind the establishment, or the sentiment, I guess, that was prominent at that time was peacemaking. Peace and justice obviously evolved very quickly after that, because when you track the chronology of it through the 80s, there seems to be more a preoccupation with issues, so issues of militarism, issues of racism, issues of sexism, issues of fundamentalism, and then they sort of morph more into a more context-specific issues. So then we start to address Sri Lanka, Sudan, Trinidad, Cuba, where, you know, I mean, you could trace that history along where world events have taken us, and that's where peace and justice began to get very involved more in the context and began to actually visit the context of many of these sites of struggle. And of conflict, and to report back to the ACC on what it was that was being seen in those areas. I actually joined the network in 1996 for its meeting in New York, and that was at the end of the first decade of its life. And interestingly, my abiding impression of that meeting was that it was a network that was then prepared to evaluate its own life, because clearly after 10 years it had evolved, but one of the major concerns within the network itself was its lack of representative credibility. Primarily, it was to do with the composition of the network, and as is wont to happen in some committees of the commission of the communion, primarily all bishops, and in the absence of bishops, their wives. So it was a delight for me to be invited into a meeting of the Peace and Justice Network that was prepared to evaluate its own life. So one of our determinations at that meeting became that of increasing the numbers of lay people, of young people, and of women in the network. And so we actually made a very intentional plea to primates who nominate people to represent their provinces on the network for them to give very serious consideration to our plea, and that has in fact happened. So I do believe that in fact our representation is credible. You can come into any meeting of the APJN and find yourself looking at the kingdom of God, fully representative. So we have, since I've been involved, the meeting in 1995 in New York was primarily focused on seriously raising the consciousness of the communion about third world debt. There had been the Lambeth Resolution 1.15 on 0.07% of provincial budgets being allocated towards the debt relief, relieving the burden of debt. So we met in that meeting with officials from the IMF, from the World Bank, and really were able to interrogate them about the ways in which their policies were at that time clearly propping up the debt burden of impoverished countries. And at the end of that meeting, we were utterly blessed to have Gustavo Gutierrez offer a theological reflection on all that we had done and the exchanges between ourselves and the officials from the World Bank and IMF and so on. So then, of course, that was the outcome and the findings and the recommendations from that meeting were heavily promoted at Lambeth 98 by Bishop Luiz Prado from Brazil, again a very long-serving member of the APJN. And so we're very proud of the results, the end results. We weren't just meeting for the sake of meeting. The meeting developed a set of resolutions and recommendations. Those have been promoted further in the councils of the church, and we believe have led to some very considerable action within at provincial level, at local church level, and certainly at leadership level, as the consciousness about these issues has been maintained. From 96 to 98, we met in Korea, and of course at that stage the issue of reunification was very, very strongly a concern and was brought to us by a member of the network, Jae Jong Lee, who, as some of you may know, up until recent times was a very senior political figure in Korea and very, very responsible. In fact, he was the Minister for Reunification, I think, up until the recent change in the Korean government. So as an Anglican priest, played a very prominent role in the extensive negotiations that continue to take place in between North and South Korea. And it was at the Korea meeting that we also put forward a recommendation to ACC on the issue of human sexuality. We understand that we were probably one of the first groups in the communion to raise it as a human rights issue. We strongly promoted the issue of human rights. We also endorsed the Lambeth 98 resolution on homosexual people being recognised as people of God. I mean, I stumble over it because it seems pretty self-evident to me, but there was a third recommendation, I just forget it at the moment, but so that was 98, that was Korea. And then 2001 we met in Aotearoa, New Zealand, a place with which I'm reasonably familiar. And of course, while it's not a site of conflict or civil war, or it too has its history of post-colonial struggle for Indigenous people, and that was primarily the reason, as a Māori person myself, I was anxious to share that experience and some of the outcomes with members of the Peace and Justice Network. And then we met in Middle East again, so Palestine remains on our agenda, and interestingly enough, we were back in Palestine 20 years after the first meeting, and of course, tragically, unable to gain any sense of proper advance or progress in the settlement of those intensely complex and intensely deadly issues that still ravage that region. And then in 2007 we met in Burundi, Rwanda, again in response to a long-term appeal from Bishop P from Burundi, who had been long wanting the Peace and Justice Network to come into the Great Lakes region to look not only at Burundi but also Rwanda and DRC as well. So we were able to visit there and report extensively on that. And I've brought along copies of the reports that I'm sure most of you have seen, but to just give you some flavour of the scope, really, of the issues with which we are involved. So there's a little chronology and little sort of pointers towards some of the issues with which we've been involved. We are extremely proud of the pursuit of God's mission work that we think we've been able to advance as a network. And we also are very proud of the fact that we intentionally collaborate with all of the other networks. I mean, again, it's very self-evident that all of these issues are interconnected. You know, the environment is about a justice issue, is about a woman's issue, is about a theological educational issue. I mean, there's no, you know, strong lines of demarcation that that exist between the networks. And right now, we actually welcome the fact that the Anglican Communion Office has put in place an infrastructure that actually allows us to strengthen those bonds of affection that we naturally feel for each other. So I leave it at that.
Thanks.
For now.
Bishop George Browning is the retired bishop of Canberra and Goulburn, most recently at a parish in Salisbury, but in this capacity here as his involvement in the Anglican Communion's environmental network. And so, George, let me just turn it to you for a few minutes and ask you to introduce that subject as well.
Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. It's very nice to be in the company of other people from my part of the world. Environmental issues were probably voiced first of all around about the 1950s, 1960s, but it's only relatively recently, in the last, as you all know, in the last perhaps 20 years, that they've come to the fore as the major, one of, if not the major issue facing humankind and the globe, and perhaps has become the major issue of the 21st century. How we deal with this issue is of the utmost importance, not just for justice today, but for future generations. As an Australian, I was terribly disappointed this morning to hear on the BBC News that the Prime Minister of Australia, for whom I have a lot of affection and time, has postponed by 1 year Australia's commitment to reduce its emission target, which was, as I say, extremely disappointing. In 1998, the Lambeth Conference decided to focus on a number of major issues, of which the environment was one. And when I got to the Lambeth Conference, I discovered I was the chair of that section of the 1998 conference, and that's basically how I've come to be the chair of this commission. In 2002, a group of us met in Pretoria, South Africa, and decided to put it to the ACC that there ought to be a network to link the communion together on this issue, because it's such a big issue. And this was done in 2003. And then in 2005, the network met formally for the first time in my city in Canberra, Australia. I hosted the meeting. And we had a good representation from all continents of the world and from both from the developed and developing countries. The difficulty that we face is, well, there are a number of difficulties that we face. One within the church itself is that there is still a large section of our church that doesn't see this as a core issue. It's a lot of people still see it as a matter which is of interest to the tree huggers, but not to the main core of Christian people for whom evangelism is our main business. So education amongst the church people is one of our main themes, both education, both theologically and morally. And a lot of work's been done on that, and it is self-evident that it is our core business, and this is expressed, of course, in the integrity of creation being the fifth mark of mission of the church, which is, if you like, our theological mandate. I have been much encouraged in recent times that more and more components of our church, particularly those from an evangelical background, have now come on board and see this as much more of the core business of the church. For if we do not focus upon this, then our other doctrines of salvation and redemption are greatly diminished. I could talk much more about that. The moral side is incredibly important because, as we all know, it is the developed countries of the world that are largely the contributors to the acceleration of climate change, and it's the poor countries of the world who are, in a deleterious way, reaping the outcome of that. And for the last 15 years or so, I've spent time in a poor country of the world every second year, and I've taken 20 young people from Australia to the Danakil Desert in Ethiopia, or a black township in South Africa, or a urban poor in Manila or in Lima in Peru. And it is very, very clear that the climate issues, environmental issues, are one of the major contributors to people being poor. And in fact, if we cannot tackle this issue, then to speak about relieving world poverty is really a nonsense. It's not possible. So dealing with this is important. And in the year 2000, as you know, when the Millennium Development Goals were set, that the environmental issue is goal number 7. But in a way, it actually underlines all the other goals, as you've already heard, because if women are now in Africa spending the whole day to collect water, they're not looking after their own health. And if children are participating in that, then they're not being educated even to a primary level. So it is an issue that affects everything else that we do. The network is very dependent, really, on a number of things. It's dependent upon passionate people at a local level taking up the cause. And the members of the network are all volunteers. We have no desk. We have no money. We have no resource. And so it's dependent upon passionate people, myself included, who are prepared to make this their number one issue. And if you were to ask me what drives me about it, well, there are two things that drive me, really. One is my faith. I absolutely believe this is a core issue to my faith. But also, I'm old now, and I have grandchildren. And I, every day, I really think about what will the world be like for my grandchildren. And I know it is morally reprehensible for me to think that I can have a lifestyle today at the price that my grandchildren will pay. There is the head of the Conservation Foundation in Australia is a man called Professor Tony Lowe, and he says that we now use up the world's resources by October each year. So from November to December onwards, if one can see it metaphorically, we are using our grandchildren's resources. And that's a fairly heavy burden for us to carry, in my view. And as far as Kevin Rudd, the Australian Prime Minister, is concerned, who said the economic issues must come before the ecological issues, I'd say to him the problems that both face are the same. Both the economy and the ecology suffer because we have been prepared to go into debt. Both the ecology and the economy suffer because people haven't taken responsibility for their actions. Both the economy and the ecology suffer because greed is rampant. And it is not possible, in my view, for the world leaders to think they can sort the economic issues without actually focusing upon the ecological issues. The two belong together. And one of the things I'll be saying in the workshops and asking the ACC to pick up is that I think at the moment that the economic crisis is certainly an ecological opportunity and it needs to be grasped. We don't want to go back, we needn't go back to the economic woes of the past and the faults of the past. We actually can establish a different way of going. And I truly believe that our problem is not a lack of resources or a lack of manpower, it's a lack of imagination. We need to imagine a different future, a future which is more cooperative, more gentle, more just, more hopeful, more sustainable. And if we can imagine that, we will be prepared to invest in it and the economy will sort itself out as we go along. Now, a few more details about the network itself. Our aim is to have a representative from every province, and our aim is to have a mixture of representatives. I was delighted yesterday to meet somebody who's prepared to come onto the network who is a highly successful businesswoman, because we need business on side. We need bishops on side, because they have an influence and they need to exercise it. But we also need grassroots people on side. And so the representative from Kenya is a young man, Eliud, who runs a business in Nairobi, and it's great to have him on board. The representative from Bangladesh is somebody who is also in business. But I'm very, very keen that we actually are, as a network, to voice the needs of the poorest of the poor, because as you visit their communities, they are the unsung heroes of the Anglican Communion, the people who actually run recycling programs in the poorest communities, who actually are planting trees in the poorest communities, who are finding new ways of growing food in the poorest communities. And I think maybe I can finish by saying that the crisis that we face is enormous for some people. The country of Tuvalu, which is a neighbour to both of us, is going underwater, and our country has said we will not take the refugees.
Ours has said they will.
But if a third of Bangladesh goes underwater, who will take the refugees?
Exactly.
Who will take the refugees? I asked somebody from America once, when will we address this? And they said, not until Manhattan goes underwater. But in the meantime, lots of others will. And I would just say what has already been said, that the networks basically are a family of concerns that cover the same ground, but this one is a huge issue, and I'm grateful to the Archbishop of Canterbury, the Bishop of London, the Bishop of Liverpool, and many others for whom they are a very strong, passionate voice.
Thank you. What I'd like to do is to alternate the questions. So first question for Jenny. Is there a question for her, Chris?
The Archbishop of Sudan has today released a passionate appeal that is evident from local reports received through the church network that arms smuggling, rearmament and incitement of tribal violence is being carried out by enemies of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. Will the Justice and Peace Network be framing a resolution of the ACC for support for his appeal to the guarantors of the CPA to consider very seriously the churches as key partners in the work of peace building? What will the ACC be doing?
I'm not at liberty, obviously, because we've just this about within the last hour finished framing the network, the resolutions. But certainly I can assure you there are at least three that I can, and I can't even remember the detail, I mean, you know, that will be going forward to ACC, because that has been one issue. Bishop Micah came to Rwanda, Burundi with us, and I mean his appeals to us and his intimate knowledge of exactly what's going on were just so heartrending, as you can well imagine. So he has been very closely involved in the development of those resolutions, and so you're certainly assured. And we understand that the Sudan delegation are arriving this afternoon, so you absolutely, we have got resolutions coming forward in Sudan.
Question for Bishop George.
Yeah, I have a question for you, Bishop. I was a little concerned about your comment about evangelicals and the environment. There is something in the States called the EEN, the Evangelical Environmental Network, of which I am myself a member of it.
Yeah.
It would seem to me that you're unfairly suggesting that they are not as concerned about the environment as other issues of salvation and redemption and grace and so forth. Are you making a false dichotomy between these two?
No, I... Forgive me if it came over in a pejorative sense. I was trying to be complimentary, and I suppose in our church there has been a dichotomy between those churches that are seen to be interested in social justice issues and those churches that are more interested in evangelistic issues. I would want to say that you can't be a Christian and without being focused on both, and the reality is in the United States of America that the evangelical church is now a very, very influential voice in environmental matters, and their impact has been both encouraging and very, very effective.
Virginia?
Dr. Tate Palm, in 2007, you reported as saying to the Chicago consultation, speaking of hypocrisy, why are two provinces continually being singled out and held to a higher standard of accountability than other members of the ecclesial family by bodies who do not actually even possess the mandated authority to demand such accountabilities in the first place? So in light of that, and your role in the Peace and Justice Network, what is your perspective on the Anglican Covenant process and how the Church exemplifies peace and justice?
I need to hear the question again, but I'm not sure, speaking as a member of the Anglican Peace and Justice Network, whether it hasn't been our issue, so I the only response I could make to you would be as a personal individual, and I'm not sure how that sits with this.
Well, I think surely the covenant process would, in the ideas of autonomy that have threaded throughout it, I'm sure that it would sort of come under the purview of the Peace and Justice Network.
It may well do, but it hasn't been considered by the network as a whole, so that's my reluctance. I'm not reluctant to answer your question, but I can't do it on behalf of the network or as a representative of the network, because we as a network have not officially made any response.
So does that mean the network does not have any concern about the
government? No, I guess as individual members we would, but it hasn't come across on our agenda as a network, no, so...
Just a second. A question for Bishop George. Back to you.
Bishop George, on the theme of evangelicals being involved in the environment, can you tell me how does the environmental concerns that your network takes on directly relate to the gospel of Jesus Christ?
Bishop Tom Wright, Bishop of Durham, has written a lot about this recently, and he's pointing out that the gospel of Jesus is the gospel of the redemption of the whole created order, and that the prologue of the gospel according to St. John, or the hymn to the universe in Colossians, indicate that God's purpose is for the redemption of the whole created order, and that individuals cannot find their salvation apart from belonging to one another and to all that God has made. So in the first chapter of the Bible, we are described as Adam, male and female. We're described as Adam, and the Hebrew word for the earth is Adamah, and so that our whole identity is really caught up in our relationship with the earth and with one another. So I see this is absolutely core to our belief in Jesus.
So when it says heaven and earth shall pass away?
My words shall not pass away. Well, but there's nothing in the scripture that indicates that we should act in an apocalyptic manner. I mean, this is our earth, this is our home, this is the place in which God has placed us. And to work for... one of the leaders of a church of another denomination in Australia said on his Easter message that Jesus said nothing about climate change. And Jesus said an awful lot about the heritage of children. He also said a lot about the injustice inflicted upon the poor, and both of these are gospel issues. And in addressing this issue, one is addressing those issues.
Dr. Dabab, I read recently, I think it was late last week, where a Pew Research finding in the United States revealed that a majority of churchgoers in the United States supported the idea of torture under certain circumstances. Now, not for one moment am I suggesting that it's representative of the views of the Anglican Church globally, but what's your own view on this matter of Christians or the Church generally supporting torture under any circumstance?
Well, I mean, I'm appalled. I don't know whether to be cynical about the process of surveying or to question seriously that would be a genuine finding. I would be dumbfounded if that were in fact true.
Tess, you?
Yeah, I've heard Dr. Tepa. Can you give us a sense of the resolutions that you'll be looking forward to the ACC, just to help us prepare for this?
Sure. Well, obviously, the resolutions that we always put forward are those based on the most recent of our exposure visits. So there will be a set on the situation in Burundi, Rwanda, Congo, and positive resolutions, we hope, because what we witnessed, apart from clearly the legacy of 94, were the most astonishing examples of reconciliation, of conflict resolution programs, of community building post-conflict, and so on. So there are a number of resolutions which will relate to that experience. Clearly we have, now these are just off the top of my head, so please don't ask me for the detail. Zimbabwe, we have something to say about Zimbabwe. Sri Lanka, Korea ongoing, Palestine. We have also a resolution based on the team conference that was held in South Africa, and we have also one to do with the topic conference, topic with a K, which was an exposure visit, which some of us were utterly privileged to go on in 2007, I believe, and some of us were able to cross into North Korea during that time. So that's sort of the spread. Pretty much the world is there.
Last question to Colin.
Jenny, you said that the network raised human sexuality as a human rights issue. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what year it was.
98.
Mm-hmm. And you referred to that section of Lambeth 110, mm-hmm. which said that homosexual people were recognised mm-hmm. as people of God. Mm-hmm. The rest of the resolution might not seem to be so congruent with human rights for lesbian and gay people. I wonder whether the network continues to monitor attitudes in the community.
Absolutely.
And in what way it does it.
Every year it's obviously a topic that we discuss among ourselves. I have to say that in Korea it was credit to a young group of students who sought our counsel. I mean, sought an audience with us, who brought who eventually led to the formation of that motion. I would also want to say the third part to it, and I knew it was important. I should have remembered it myself, but it was our concern that the issue of hermeneutics be raised up. Way back then, my province is involved in a pioneering hermeneutics project, so it mattered to us then that we could sense the potential for, well, not the potential, the actual misuse of scripture to support various positions on this matter, and we were trying to alert the communion to it way back that long ago. So it's always been with us, Colin, and always will until justice prevails.
Thank you. I think you may both be involved in network work at this point.
Yeah.
So I will thank you very much for coming, and we appreciate you taking the time and sharing with us.
Thank you.
Thanks
thank
indeed.
You. Thank you.